Welcome, everyone, to a very, very special episode of Podcast Them Softly. This is Frank. I'm here with my podcasting partner and co-host and co-founder, Nick. Hello, Nick.
What's going on, Frank? How you doing?
Doing well. Doing well. We're very excited to have writer-director Steve DeJarnett on our show today. Steve's two cult favorites from the late 80s, Cherry 2000 and Miracle Mile, have just hit Blu-ray, thanks to the wonderful people over at Kino. Thank you, Kino, for sending us the discs in advance with our chat with Steve. They are two very terrific films, unique pieces of entertainment, and finally got the respect they deserve. Cherry 2000 was released in 1988 and served as a Mad Max-inspired precursor to tons of sci-fi works that would find a release in the 90s. And in 1989, he unleashed Miracle Mile, which he wrote and directed, and which stars Anthony Edwards and Mare Winningham as two potential Los Angeles soulmates who just happen to meet each other on the last day of Earth. It's a wild film that goes to some surprising places, and it's a work that seems to have found recent rediscovery with critics and audiences. Steve is also an accomplished writer and has been selected for inclusion in the 2009 edition of the Best American Short Stories for his work, Reuben X Rising. While his original script for Miracle Mile was selected by American Film Magazine in 1983 as one of the 10 best unproduced screenplays making the rounds in Hollywood, his other eclectic credits include co-writing the classic comedy Strange Brew with Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas, and he ventured into television with directing stints on ER, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and Lizzie McGuire, and writing work on The X-Files, and the short-lived fantastic series American Gothic, which was also produced alongside Sam Raimi. Welcome to the show, Steve. It's an absolute pleasure to get a chance to speak with you.
Likewise, I'm thrilled to be on your podcast and talk about the my very minor and brief oeuvre of 80s cult films.
Thanks a lot, Steve, for coming on, and we'll get to that in a little bit about maybe why there wasn't more from Steve DeJarnett, but we do at least have these two really awesome pieces of work to talk to you about, and we know you've also had some other stuff going on in your career as well, which we'll get to as well. But thank you very much for coming on the show. I know, like I said before in our warm up before we started recording, Miracle Mile was one of those movies that I had a chance to see when I was younger, and getting a chance to see it now has come to mean something completely different. So I can only imagine how there's probably a lot of people like me at 35 years of age who saw that film as a youngster, as a teen, and now they're going to get a chance to relive it. So it's got to be pretty exciting to see both of these out on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I also want to thank Frank Tarzi at Kino, who, called me up, I think just right at the beginning of the year, and said, we're putting both these out, and I don't think they can be actually packaged into a two for one, but the fact that they're released at the same time, I think, is really cool too. So,
yeah, it's it is really cool, and it's one of those things too where you're like a company like Kino and other companies like it, like the Twilight Times, they're really sort of going out of their way to find these movies that deserve a reappraisal and a rediscovery and the chance to get out there on Blu-ray. Frank and I are big fans of physical media. We're fans of holding the actual movie in our hands. We also understand the importance and the value of streaming. But it's awesome that there's companies out there that are, they're putting out these gems, these lost gems, these cult films, these great movies that people grew up with and that, have basically been lost to the sea of time. So it's really wonderful that they were able to do this.
Yeah. I like the physical thing too. I didn't even have a Blu-ray till this was coming out. And then I thought they were really expensive. They're only like 40 or 50 bucks. So I've definitely gone on to getting, a Blu-ray machine and proceeding from there. So, and yeah, it's nice to have them. Streaming, most people are going to be doing, but I still have wax. I don't, for records too. So,
I mean, but streaming, sometimes you have to do it. I know Nick's not a huge fan, but I am, and it's difficult to find a lot of films on physical media in region one. as opposed to being able to rent it on Vudu or Amazon Instant Video.
Yeah, or just, I mean, I have a DVR, so, you know, the Turner Classic Movies I fill up. I wish I could keep a box separate and download them, just doing that channel, like the Noir series that Eddie Muller's been doing, and just all kind of, I mean, I think today they're doing Michael Caine stuff, and I just recording everything, you know, Ipcress File and
right,
and It Would Be King and everything. So
awesome. So your first film, Cherry 2000. I know this is a crazy juggernaut of a film. When I rewatched it last night, the thing that I felt like I most wanted to ask you out of all the questions I had about the film is, how do you concept what it's going to look like in the future?
Well, for this film, for Cherry, you know, it's weird. Well, isn't it set in 2017 or something? I mean, it's, we're almost there. So
I get the kick out of that.
You know, we have our little cheap, you know, Vegas is, all right, it's supposed to be Anaheim. We shot in Vegas. Little minuscule Blade Runner shot there. But, you know, it's a rundown world more so than Blade Runner, because it didn't really get built that much. So, you know, it's a world we could have gone into maybe if the economy had really tanked when you know, the banks crashed the market. If we hadn't been resurrected, if we really would have gone into recycling, or if we had a few natural disasters or something, the sort of future of Cherry isn't that far off. You know, we still haven't got to perfect mates for robot mates yet, though. So
right,
a little contradictory. But,
okay.
That when I came on the picture, and one of the reasons I do talk about Miracle Mile and Cherry differently is, you know, Miracle Mile, I wrote it. It's really sort of planned out and executed with my minor budget we had as much as I possibly could. Cherry, I sort of jumped on a moving train. There already was a production designer, John DeCure, who bankrupted two studios or maybe it was Fox twice for Hello Dolly and Cleopatra. You know, he did Ghostbusters, legendary guy. But he disappeared. I don't know. I thought he was our production designer, but he just did some sketches, and then the art director had to build everything. You know, you're jumping on a movie that's already, you know, the train's already left the station, and you're just trying to catch up and do what you can in those circumstances. So you bring in the talented people. Julie Weiss, who did the costumes, I think probably really makes the movie worthwhile in her vision.
Crazy costumes. Yeah, just yeah. Wild. The whole film, not to cut you off, but so many elements of the film feel like they were reused later on, and especially in the 90s.
I've heard that, but what I have no idea. What do you think, like, it might have influenced? I don't know.
Well, like one of the things that immediately struck me, because again, while I was familiar with Cherry 2000, it was not something I had a chance to see until Kino sent over the Blues.
Oh.
Miracle Mile was my entry into, you know, you as a filmmaker. That's what I saw when I was younger. And again, when I had a chance to see it not too long ago, it was like, you know, it's, I love revisiting these films from, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that again, I grew up with, meant something at one point and then become something completely different. I couldn't help but feel that Cherry 2000 inspired like, Demolition Man, you know, the whole aspect of Cherry 2000 about the, you know, the sex contract and everything and the relationship stuff, that to me felt like the stuff that they ripped off in Demolition Man, where there was no more sex and all the stuff was being regulated. And Sandra Bullock, and if you recall, Sandra Bullock and him Stallone on those headgears. Some of the art direction, some of the set direction was reminiscent of Tank Girl. I don't know if you're familiar with Tank Girl.
I am familiar with that. I haven't actually seen that, but yeah, that's a water thing. It's funny that you mentioned both those, because I'm surprised that, well, probably if on Cherry, they already had John DeCure, I probably would have hired David L. Snyder, who I'd actually hired on Strange Brew to do it. But he was the art director of Blade Runner. He pretty much built everything, and he did Demolition Man.
No idea. Yeah, it's just one of those things where Cherry 2000 has, like Frank brought up to me last night when we were chatting, it has the Mad Max feel. It has sort of cut from that cloth. It has a Gilliam flavor to it, I felt as well, in sort of the eccentricity of the humor, and how you're sort of going back and forth between social commentary, action, science fiction, romance. You know, I'm a huge fan of movies that juggle tone and aren't easily classifiable. And that's sort of like, you know, with your two films, that's just how it's like perfect in that.
Yeah, they both, make an odd boulabaisse of different things. And, you know, so the people that love them, you know, really appreciate that. Some people, it frustrates them because it's, they don't really know what to expect.
There, as Frank and I like to say, there's 31 flavors.
There's some movie coming out, Turbo Kid, a New Zealand director. And another person I contacted recently through, you know, sort of putting the word out on Facebook and other places. And he said it was very influential. And I think he had a theater and he ran Cherry for months or something in New Zealand, which is pretty remarkable. And it's I think, you know, of the ilk. And I think it's coming out now. It's supposed to be pretty good, I guess.
Not familiar.
I'm going to have to check that one out.
I think
certainly.
It's a new movie. I think it's, you know, I know they're screening it in Los Angeles down at the Ace Hotel, which is a pretty big thing to do. So, you know, and of course, yeah, Cherry is a, Mad Max light or whatever. You know, it's our homage to that. And it was made by the same studio approximately at the same time as RoboCop, which I am in awe of, two robot movies. And we probably have the same budget, you know, $6 or $8 million or something. I don't even know what it was, but I do think that one got a lot more on screen. It was a little more contained. We were filming in all these toxic locations all over Nevada, and Ann Coolgen, who built the sets, did a remarkable, or, you know, who designed the sets. She's gone on to do Spielberg movies and big things. Julie Weiss, the costumer, we mentioned Terry Gilliam. She had done 12 Monkeys and stuff too. So, you know, when you have major talent like that, that's really helped you. Yeah.
That was one of the first things I felt last night while watching it. It was like, it felt to me like cut from the same craziness of Gilliam. So again, I'm not surprised to hear you say that somebody who worked on that film would then go on to work on a Gilliam movie.
Yeah.
Especially as evocative as 12 Monkeys, which is just nuts.
Well, you can see in that just how putting people in plastic. I mean, she'd put bikers. We would have extras that are hardcore bikers. She'd put them in a dress, and she'd go up to them and go, "Now, if you have a problem with your masculinity, she's amazing. She should work. I mean, she did Frida and American Beauty. I mean, she's very big, but no costume designer is on the set caring about what each extra is wearing. I actually, you know, if you want to include it on your podcast, I'll have to figure out how to get to you. I have a great, like, 8 or 11 minute interview with Julie that I was hoping to put on the extras. We didn't quite get it done in time. And she's just a brilliant creative mind. I think she probably gave Cherry 2000 more thought than any other department. It's really, really pretty remarkable.
Yeah, certainly. We would we could put that on our page we can put it on our website for sure. That'd be great. Another thing that I absolutely love about Cherry 2000 is the cast you put together. And David Andrews is wonderful, and as is Melanie Griffith, but the supporting cast of like Harry Carey Jr. and Brian James, and particularly Ben Johnson. I've loved Ben Johnson. I grew up watching John Ford movies with my dad. You know, I absolutely love The Wild Bunch. That's one of my all-time favorite films. And it was incredibly cool to see Ben Johnson in a film like this.
You know, it's I don't know what he made of it. I do know that he made more money than anybody else on the film. he had a high weekly rate, and because of scheduling, you'd have to keep bringing him back for something. So I think he made the most money. Wonderful guy. And yes, Dobie Carey, as he's known, you know, Harry Carey Jr., and Ben, you know, worked together in many, many Westerns. And that really sells the, you know, the futuristic Western aspect of the film. I think that, you know, really that and Basil's score really, you know, give it that unique futuristic Western tone.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, speaking of the score, I'm a huge fan of Tangerine Dream, which is on Miracle Mile.
Right.
Jeez, I fucked that up. That's going to get edited out.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Nick. You should have cut me off. It would have been so much better.
No, I was going to – I just wanted to ask how the screenplay by Michael Almereyda
Almereyda.
Michael Almereyda's screenplay. He's had such a unique career – and I was just curious to know how the project even, you know, had its genesis. You know, like, it's not something that you wrote, and you said that you were brought in, you know, after the fact, and they had been having stuff done. Do you know sort of how the project had come about, or?
Relatively. I mean, my history, too, I don't know if you've had a chance to watch the film noir short Tarzana. I made that and went from being a busboy in Hollywood to being a Hollywood director overnight, essentially. And wrote Miracle Mile and wanted to make that. So I'd pretty much turned down 30 or 40 features. I mean, the more I turned down, the more people wanted me between 1978 and 85 or 86.
And Miracle Mile that was on that list of best unproduced screenplays.
Right. So you know. There was opportunities to not direct that or sell it back and change the ending. I was a maniacal, snotty little auteur who only wanted to make his movie. But it was a very weird day, and I've told this story before, how I got onto Cherry. I was getting ready to make Miracle Mile for $2 million, which was not going to be enough. Sorry, that's the Facebook doing their thing. With Nick Cage for $2 million. And I had a deal with Medavoy at Orion, and he calls me up and goes, "We're sending you this script. The director just fell out." I think it was Irv Kirshner was directing Cherry. And I said, "No, I can't. You know, John Daly's doing all the banking. You know, we're getting ready to make this movie." And an hour later, Nick's attorney, who was Coppola's attorney, some big guy, calls up and says, "We're pulling Nick out of Miracle Mile. You can do it in like a year and a half, but he's gonna do Peggy Sue Got Married and these other three pictures first." And I went, "No, wait, I got to talk to Nick. That can't be. He's on Catalina without a phone. That's the way it is, kid." So I tried to get a hold of Nick. And I couldn't, and I called up Mike Medavoy and said, "Send me the script." And I read 20 pages, and I said, "This is wonderfully weird." And I hadn't even finished the script, and I jumped on a movie. So the history of Cherry, though, Cotty Chubb, who certainly deserves a lot of credit as a creative force in the film, his friend Lloyd Fonville, who passed away recently, I think had come up with the story. Lloyd's credited with the story. And, you know, then they'd hired Michael to write the script. So it was already, you know, a go project at Orion with a director with a release date with, you know, Ed Pressman was the other big producer. Of course, I'm sure you know all his pictures.
Oh, yeah.
Lieutenant, I mean, a million. And so they were desperate to get a director, and I became that director. I think David Fincher turned it down before me or something. He hadn't done any movies yet. But You know,
Fincher turned it down. That's awesome.
Well, he had done rock videos. I wrote a script for Fincher for Robbie Robertson and Scorsese, you know, a long time ago too. But everybody wanted Fincher, and of course, he's truly panned out as one of the great filmmakers we have today. So,
and I wanted to ask too. Also, we should talk about the music by Basil Poliodorus.
Poliodorus, yeah, that's.
Yep, Basil Poliodorus.
Yep.
How did the collaboration with Basil come about? And because the score is just it's just superb. I mean, it punctuates all the action. The action sequences too. We got to talk about those as well. But
sure.
How did the collaboration with Basil get come about?
Well, Basil was it's weird, and you listen to the commentary too. I go into this. My only thing I'd ever directed other than my short film professionally was earlier in the year. I'd done a 4-part TV movie, which was a reboot of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents show. And it then turned into a TV series, but I got to do the sort of, super episode with the best cast of Man from the South. It's a Roald Dahl story where, it's a bet about lighting a cigarette lighter 10 times you get your finger cut off. The original was Peter Lorre and Steve McQueen. My cast was John Huston, Kim Novak, Tippi Hedren, Melanie, her husband at the time, Steve Bauer, Rocky Echevarria, who's back doing great work. He was in Scarface. And Basil scored that. So that's how we got together. And there was a brief meeting once with Frank Zappa, who wanted to score Cherry.
Oh, wow.
And had written G-Spot Tornado or something. And, got to go to his house, and he's running Cherry. And and that would have been great, of course. I think it was Cotty, Ed, I don't know, whatever, the producers. Somehow it came up that we might have to abridge the score. And Zappa said, no, fuck that. It's a Zappa score. You can't change a note. And so that the deal never happened. But, I'm glad in retrospect, as I'm glad I made Miracle Mile with Tony and Mare, and it would have been really weird and culty with Nick Cage and Jennifer Tilly, I think, was going to be, before she'd done anything. Because Nick was going to play the character he ended up playing in Peggy Sue Got Married, whatever that voice is and sort of weird rockabilly thing. That was his Harry Washello. So I don't know if you'd be talking to me if that would have happened. maybe it would have been fantastic. Anyway. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to ask another question, but if you wanted to continue.
No, you prompt me with the next thing. I'm just rambling.
Oh, no worries. One of the things that stood out, and especially considering obviously the comparatively lower budget that was afforded, the action scenes feel large and they feel real and they feel like they, there's a weight behind them. How were some of those stunts? How were some of the stunts even planned out or achieved? I mean, there's so much sort of large scale action going on in many parts of it. Was that an enjoyable thing for you to stage or film?
Well,
why did
it was a little frustrating. I mean, we had a great second unit guy, Max Clevin, who just had done Back to the Future and big things. And John DeCure, when we were in that first process of designing stuff and scouting locations, the only thing we changed in the script really were when we found some incredible locations, we made up crazy action scenes for them. Don't make entirely a lot of sense, the big magnet, but we had this great abandoned gold field with strychnine in the soil or something outside of Goldfield, Nevada, with that weird territory where we blew up everything. And somehow the big stunt was going to be the car getting picked up by a magnet and then dropped over Hoover Dam that we did have a matte shot where you actually saw it sort of in ruins. You get a little glimpse of that in there. The effect shots didn't really pan out too well. They were glass plate shots, old school. But the action is good because it's real action, you know, no CGI. Today I yawn at most movies. I just go, oh, everything's spinning, you know, going through impossible holes in a building, and your people are out running fireballs, and it's, you know, it's you're whizzing impossibly through things. I don't know. It makes me yawn. I mean, it's great when it first happened, but there's something about real stunts that needs to be used again, because some of the best underappreciated people in Hollywood are stunt people, coordinators and stunt people, and they need to work again. They need to be appreciated with an Oscar. They are not given an Oscar. They never have been.
It's a joke.
The star's ego is that I did my stunts. Yeah, right. I mean, sure, you do some, but it's the fact that they – in fact, I would love to have, you know, Clint Eastwood or somebody with some clout should do a retroactive Oscars ceremony, nominate 5 pictures going back to the 30s or whatever, Yakima Canut, and give stunt people and coordinators their due. It's true crime of Hollywood that they've been, you know, the assistant sound editor, well, you know, the sound editors are great, but I'm sorry, these stunt people have contributed more to Hollywood than anybody, and they deserve
Oscars. Put their
Oscars
on the line for entertainment.
Yeah, Tracy Keene, I think she has a hyphen new name now. You know, there's a real woman on the back of that Mustang. That's a real stunt. Now, we get, you know, as a director, you get to envision this stuff, storyboard it, all that. You know, those people take over and make and, you know, do that when the day comes, because it's, you know, people can die if you don't do it right. I do remember a couple times there was an interesting argument between me and the producers when I refused to shoot something because I didn't think it was safe. The opposite of some other directors I won't name. And, you know, usually the director goes, I got to have it. We got to go for it. And I refused to shoot it because I think that sent the stunt woman home and for Melanie, and they wanted her stand-in, Bambi McCracken, who's 17-year-old Tonopah High School girl, to pull up, and it just started freezing, and we were lit for a whole city block, and I wouldn't shoot it. So I didn't want to risk that. So anyway, interesting dynamic that usually doesn't happen.
That's fascinating. I absolutely love it in Cherry 2000. One of my favorite things. I also, this is obscure, but the other thing that I love about the film is towards the beginning of the film when David Andrews is going to the hotel, the cat that's inside of like that water, the water container, and how the lady's just feeding it through the top.
Now those things, I mean, you get to add a lot of that stuff, even if you only have 8 weeks or 7 weeks. So yeah, that's a kitten caboodle. You know, I always would joke about putting kittens in bottles and growing them and selling them at swap meets. So you get to put those weird things in, or when the car, I can't even see it. Even if you blew it up, maybe on the Blu-ray, you can see it. When the car comes around that corner, there's an old marquees of a pod mall in the future. And it says El Snake-O Loco instead of, El Polo Loco. And it also says half-hour Martinizing. Because in the future, whatever one-hour Martinizing is, I'm not sure what it is, but we'll be able to do it in a half hour. So that was my tiny little, you know, Idiocracy touches back then. And you don't see it, and you make a big deal, and you have meetings, and we got to have half-hour Martinizing in the background, and we got to have this and that. And you realize what's really important and what's not. But it's more important to have Robert Zadar with his face in the background. The cat is an interesting little thing. Jennifer Balgobin, who plays that character, I think got dubbed. I don't know why. She's the mohawked punk and Repo Man. And, you know, you try to get as many cult actors in there as you can for any part, make it work.
So then, like, Robert Zadar, he was purposed. You sought him out to get him for the film? Or?
No, I don't think he had done anything that I'd never seen him. He just, you know, you meet an actor like that and you go, well, you know, let's make
right.
it happen. I don't Maniac Cop or whatever he's known for.
Yeah,
I think this is one of his early things. I can't be sure about that, but so of course, Brian James, you know, from Blade Runner, you know that, and you just
right.
cast him from seeing him in that. Him and Tim Thomerson were buddies. I think I mentioned that in the commentaries. I think they were in the Army together, so, and then had done other movies. So, you know, those guys are just gold, you know. They can't, you know. Claude Earl Jones, who's also in that scene, is also in Miracle Mile, another great character actor.
How did Melanie Griffith get involved?
She got it. Well, like I said, we'd done the Hitchcock thing. So someday I might tell a story, but not today. I think it came down to a list of three approved people. I don't know why. And Melanie's, you know, it's a weird dynamic because, you know, Melanie usually plays the softer roles. And, you know, this is sort of a weird thing where she's playing the man and David Andrews is playing the girl.
Yeah, now, it's great.
If it would have been Jamie Lee Curtis, which I don't know why that didn't work out, and Kevin Costner or something, you know, who hadn't done anything, you know, something like that, you know, and we could have really prepped it. It might be this whole other movie, but I don't know if it would be as weird and quirky. Jodie Foster was the first choice, and she had wanted to do it. And,
really?
Someday I'll tell the story of that. I can't without shaming. Major studio person, but if we meet in person, I'll tell you. But
awesome,
so. Fair enough. and one of the things I really liked about Melanie Griffith in the movie is that, again, I know it was early, you know, relatively early on in her career, she had that soft, really sexy look. And then you stuck her with the guns and made her, you know, basically the hero, you know, switching the role, you know, the gender roles. And that was something, again, that's come into play this year with Fury Road, with, you know,
yeah.
the Charlize Theron character kicking ass and sort of the Tom Hardy character. I would have to assume, well, hope that you saw the film. And if you did, assume that you enjoyed it, especially on a practical level. Frank and I were masterfuls.
Listen, I'm sort of embarrassed sometimes at how you could use Chair 2000 in any of the Mad Max movies in the same sentence. I mean, to me, Road Warrior is a masterpiece. I'll give you an example of how much I care about Road Warrior. And the new one is fantastic. When a Miracle Mile, I bought it back from Warner Brothers and had an offer for huge money to sell it back to not direct. The only person I would approve of was George Miller. So, you know, I mean, to me, we're like a 70s TV movie version of Citizen Kane as Road Warrior. We're, I mean, you know, I it's like,
it's better than that, but
we got a few cents.
No, I would say.
But Road Warrior and, I mean, as much as I could on Miracle Mile, yeah, I talked about this on the commentary. It was boarded. I had a vision. The camera's going to be here. This shot connects to that shot. There's a reason for the whole language of the film. Cherry was storyboarded. There were a lot of plans, but because of logistics or sets not being built or weather or, you know, personalities, things like that, I would say a good portion of the movie, you had to throw out what you're planning and just grab it. You had to grab it by the end of the day. The weather had changed. Somebody's not available. The set's not ready. You don't have the money to do what you wanted to do, and you end up getting what you got. And I'm glad it's appreciated, but it's not designed. It's a little more grab bag. A lot of movies do that now. They shoot with 5 cameras and just grab stuff. But I prefer movies that really have a dynamic point of view. When I saw RoboCop too, I was just, you know, felt really terrible because, you know, the vision of that film is very specific and very awesome, and they got all the money on the screen. So, I know that's just my deferring to greater filmmakers on those subjects.
Yeah, I mean, just to reiterate what Nick said, I felt there was a very close kinship between Cherry 2000 and particularly the latest Mad Max with the Melanie Griffith character and Charlize Theron's character, and as to where she's the hero and she's the one that saves the day, and it's very empowering. And, you know, I hate to throw labels like feminism around, but that's what I took from Cherry 2000.
I think that was very prescient of the script, both Lloyd and Michael. And, you know, certainly I, you know, felt that way and made that work too. It just played at Harvard at the Radcliffe Institute in a gender studies feminist film screening thing, and there are reasons why, because you opt for the flesh and blood messy relationship at the end rather than having your perfect domesticated programmed partner, and
yeah.
I think certainly those themes are we've caught up to those, and they were a little bit advanced in those days. People wanted Arnold with a gun to save the day, and it is a little subversive in that regard. And you know, I think Cotty's trying to remake Cherry with Dakota Johnson, you know, Melanie's daughter. I don't know where that is in the development thing.
What?
But,
Wow.
Anything can get remade nowadays, and you know, it feels so much of it for me. Cherry 2000 feels like one of those movies that just was made at the right time and the right thing. Just for the, you know, again, looking at it from the viewer, maybe not from the filmmaker. I know every filmmaker we've talked to so far loves to say things about their work that Frank and I wouldn't see because we didn't make them. To me, that movie feels like a perfect slice of mid to late 80s. Genre bending, and in today's climate, maybe you can figure out a way to get away with it. But I said in my written review, it just doesn't feel like a movie that could ever get pushed through any part of out of the studio system. So the idea that Dakota Johnson might take some of this newfound 50 Shades of Grey money and fame and possibly do a reimagining of Cherry 2000, that is actually kind of cool to ponder. So let's hope that maybe there's some.
If they get the right thing, it is the charm of the film that exists is that 80s weirdness, you know, and also Miracle Mile. I mean, I sort of expect somebody's going to remake Miracle Mile at some point. A lot of people have talked to me about it, but you know, the only thing I want to change in Miracle Mile is I want to CGI the mayor's mullet into a different hairstyle. But I would like $1 million to do that. But otherwise, I'm very happy with that movie. But
Transitioning to Miracle Mile, that film is insanely great. I love it. I love the humor to the film. There's so many times where I am actually laughing out loud,
you know,
while watching the film.
It shocks me. I'm going to get some water over here.
Good.
That in a theater, and I just saw it again, you know, with an audience, people can laugh all the way up to almost the very end, you know, even the guy getting run over holding Variety. And it kind of astounds me how much laughter it can get when I watch it with people. It's, you know, luckily, hopefully they're not laughing at the very end, but
I don't laugh at the end, but a lot of Alan Rosenberg's lines in the film, he's very, very, very good in that, and I've always enjoyed him as an actor. And Miracle Mile's another, that's another great example of a bunch of great character actors that are assembled around the leads.
Yeah, we got them together, which I don't even know how we did it. There's so many things on Miracle Mile, and I think all through the commentary with Teo, my DP, and Chris Horner, we're just going, how did we do this? How did we get that location? How did we, you know, shoot 7 weeks of nights and block off the streets for $3.7 million, you know, below the line. It was like four or five or something all in. Even though, even in 80s dollars, it's not very much. Back then, people thought you had to have 20. I don't know how we made that movie. Anyway, the humor in that, I think you need when you're doing a subject as dark as we end up doing at the end. So,
yeah, one of the things about Miracle Mile that I just – I just – again, getting back to what sort of I really respond to is, as a viewer, the juggling of tone in Miracle Mile is just is striking. And, you know, you just don't see that all the time nowadays. And I loved how the film was able to go back and forth between comedy – real drama, romance, the all in one night feel, which I've always loved. You know, this to me is sort of like in LA after hours. You know, I couldn't help but feel when I was watching it that some of the insanity reminded me of some of After Hours. And
I've heard that comparison. Now, I wasn't influenced by After Hours, at least, you know, writing it, because I wrote it just in 1980, you know, just before the new decade. So, and it was a pretty well-known script. I mean, very well-known going around. So I don't know. I can't remember when After Hours came out, but yeah, certain, yeah. That and Into the Night was another one that's, you know, yep. there could be a festival of nocturnal films, I guess, but yeah.
All in one night narratives have always held great appeal to me personally. And yeah, it's a whole subgenre of films that all sort of trade off of, you know, the crazy possibilities of one night in a big city with a lot of weird people. And, you know, I just think that one of the really fun elements of Miracle Mile is the sequence at the phone booth when he intercepts that call. And, you know, again, given that I saw it when I was younger, I'm wondering, you know, how many people were thinking at the time, is this ending going to really happen? Is this really going to occur? And you made a comment, you know, earlier that it sounded like you were never at any point going to change your ending. Because I did see on the behind the scenes on the Miracle Mile Blu-ray, Anthony Edwards' first reaction to reading the script was one of anger because of the ending. And I guess if people are listening to this, you know, they'll know the ending. At the end of Miracle Mile, essentially the end of the world does occur.
They get away. They get out of the tar. They're covered with tar. They do get to the heliport. They barely make on the last flight. And they lived happily ever after in Antarctica. we cut that out. No, I'm kidding. people, I mean, it was intentionally, you know, I wanted to set up a very light romance and then pull the rug out from under that and make you tread the line of, is this a dream? Is this happening? Am I Chicken Little? Am I the only person who knows? And even, you know, when you're in the department store, you're supposed to think, well, I'm in big trouble. I might have got some people killed, but at least the world's not ending. And then, to me, one of my favorite moments is when you go out and the SWAT teams are running away. And you could still be Chicken Little, but it's, you know, you've really – today it would all be tweeting. It would be like, you know, people are able to communicate so much faster. Only Landa was able to communicate with her massive, you know, cell phone at the time. So I don't know if they did remake it today – I don't know how it would play. I do know that the original script, the only thing I would say is go back to the original script, which was an older character, still a trombone player, but the reconciliation story. He was in town and he hadn't seen his ex in 15 years. So he barges in the middle of the night with this news and maybe sort of it stalked her a little bit during his coming out to play with his jazz band. And that's powerful dynamic. I sort of put that into the grandparents. But if somebody remade it, I would say do that and, you know, get what's his name from, you know, played Walter White or something, you know, an older guy to be Harry. Don't do the two people meeting and falling in love. And you know, maybe Putin will invade Ukraine and the Cold War will be back, and you know, it'll help the Blu-ray sales, and
we'll all be dead.
Go Putin. Yeah. That's being a little selfish. I'm kidding, of course. But I do like to point out to audiences, I just did this in Seattle. We had a couple of events. It's much more likely that the missiles go off tonight than back then. Everybody goes, oh, Cold War's over. No, they're still pointed. And no, there's no, you know, sack. You know, nobody's paying attention. It's like somebody, you know, in Russia particularly. I mean, some, you know, could much easily happen tonight than back then. We had mutual assured destruction then. Now we don't know what we have. So it still could play. Yeah.
I think for me, the movie turns into something. Miracle Mile is constantly turning over on itself for me, and it's becoming one thing at one moment, another thing the next. When the sequence with Michael Leddy Williamson, when the cops go up in flames,
right?
That's when the film becomes something that I would have to assume that people did not expect that. Am I correct in saying that? Is that that moment, because it's just so, you know, like what I thought back in the day was like kind of comically funny when I was a kid. Like, I didn't really get it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm watching it a couple weeks ago and I'm saying to myself, damn, like this movie plays for keeps. I forgot about how this movie has that sensibility running through it. And, you know, there's some like pretty graphic violence. You took advantage of the R rating at times, you know, without being exploitive. Yeah. As a filmmaker making this film, I have to imagine you were really excited to make, what was it like for you to be able to get a little bit of everything into this feature film?
Well, I mean, to me, all that was in the script. I don't know if as much as I love the movie, so there's something about a script when you're reading it that it can be $100 million movie and you get to do the CGI or something. So the script was very powerful. I mean, I think me and everybody involved in Miracle Mile got so much on screen that it really works. I think all the tone was in there somehow. There wasn't a lot of surprises that came along. There is a little outtake reel on the Blu-ray, but there's not a lot of stuff. There was a scene with Joe Turkel in the elevator when they finally get back together. We cut out, and I knew we were cutting it out when we were filming it. But it's pretty lean on that. Whereas a lot of movies, you shoot a lot of footage and you sort of find the film in the editing room. But Miracle Mile is pretty much intended. We got what we intended to do.
One thing I wanted to ask you was, how did casting Eddie Bunker come along?
I was a big fan of Nobis So Fierce, which he wrote the novel and turned into Straight Time. He'd been doing some acting. He wrote Runaway Train, and he's in that. I know Teo's wife, Michelle Ohayon, who's a documentary filmmaker, and I think developed, you know, a couple of Eddie's books to make. I think that's how that happened. And, you know, he's an amazing guy, no longer with us. But let's just say he knew how to use a sawed-off shotgun.
I'm sure he did.
We were downtown, and, you know, and Eddie's the real deal. And who was it? Somebody was telling me, maybe it was Teo. Somebody was telling me a great Eddie story of how to make prison coffee. You know, where you steal the grounds out of the commissary's thing and you strain it through your underwear, and you know, it's or he made coffee for somebody. I don't know where that was, but it was Eddie's. You know, I mean, what a remarkable life. And they have made a few other movies of his. I think Little Boy Blue maybe is what Michelle was going to try to make. But
no, I was just going to ask you about the casting of the rest of the cast, in particular Anthony Edwards.
Well, Anthony Edwards was the perfect guy at the end of the day. And the movie got made because, you know, he was Goose in Top Gun and had some cachet. And John Daly, who ran Hemdale, I got a lot of people who made movies with him. didn't talk to him later because he didn't necessarily give you your money, but he let us make it. In the end, he let us pull off the ending we wanted to do, and he probably wanted someone other than Mare in it, but we, Tony and I, fought for her because she really makes it work. I will tell you a little thing on here too. Tony and Mare are now their characters in real life. They're a couple. That just happened. So
that's amazing.
That's probably the most amazing thing in putting out these Blu-rays.
When they did their interview at Kino, were they a couple then? Because it was funny.
They were downplaying it. They were like,
there was this like, it was funny. There's a little joke that he says to her that was like a dismissive joke that only someone would say to somebody if they were really friendly. And she laughed about it.
They've known each other forever and, had children and all that. So yeah, that's, I've mentioned it a few times, but it's, I'm just so happy for them because they're the greatest.
Circle of life. That's great.
And, I couldn't have made it if they were not the complete trooper, everybody involved. I mean, Teo, my DP, the AD, everybody had to really get everything on screen. Cherry, sometimes I say I refereed the movie. I didn't direct it because I didn't have – I love the actors, but there was a lot more battling going on. And same thing, the DP I hired, is not a guy I wanted to go back into the trenches with. So I tried to get Teo Vondesanti over to shoot Cherry as well.
The Steadicam work on Miracle Mile was fantastic. Especially that one desperate shot of Anthony Edwards there, like in the third act. It's in the third act, and he's running through various buildings, and it's very, very, very clear that it was one extended take, and there was tons of background extras, people all having to hit their marks.
We had great – Gary Jensen was the stunt guy on that. I think after this did The Usual Suspects and some other Bryan Singer films. Bryan Singer was a big fan of Miracle Mile back when he was starting anyway. And then who was it? Elizabeth Ziegler. We had several Steadicam people because we shot a lot of pickup shots later too. She, I think, did the last Kubrick movie and she's like 6'2" and had her running up the stairs, really remarkable.
Yeah. A lot of up shots I noticed too in the hallway.
Yeah. Peter Berg, I point out on the commentaries, was Tony's stand-in. You can see him in the trombone scene there. I bumped into him recently and he said, "Oh, let's remake it." He could probably get it in development anyway. He's a big time guy now.
Yeah, you can get it done now, Peter Berg. It's funny, I didn't notice that at all, and I'm a big fan of Peter Berg as an actor and as a filmmaker. I loved him in, Fire in the Sky and freaking like Aspen Extreme, which was like Top Gun on the ski slopes. It was like that movie he did back in the day.
He does it all. I don't know how many people there are that can act, write, and direct, and like probably produce, of course, too, on the scale does. So
All right, now I get to ask the question I've been waiting to ask most of the podcast, is I am in love with Tangerine Dream, in love with them. I have the Thief soundtrack on vinyl. I have most of the soundtracks that I can find. I have the Miracle Mile soundtrack on I wish I had it on cassette. I'm sure I could find that on eBay, on CD. It's so great. How did that come about?
Well, I mean, that's another thing that to me just amazes me that we really got it. I wrote the script to the Sorcerer soundtrack. I mean, I'm up in the middle of the night, playing that. And, and Hemdale stepped up. I mean, there's really no other choice. In that regard, it was, and you put the temp music on, which was, 80% Tangerine Dream cues. And then the Birdie soundtrack, I think we use some. Very, bittersweet, though, because we just lost Edgar just a few months ago. Tangerine Dream is always Edgar Froge and somebody else or some other people. For Miracle Mile, it was just Edgar and Paul Hasslinger, who lives in L.A. and is scoring a lot of films now. And I got to go over to Vienna and work with them, and it was, you know, one of the most amazing times of my life. And, you know, they'll magnanimously, you know, if you put the Risky Business cue in there in your temp music, it's their music. They'll kind of alter it enough so you can use it, but it's somewhat different. We had talked about trying to put out a special vinyl edition, you know, 1,000 copies.
Yeah.
Of the true underscore, because the score that comes out on CD or whatever, they add a lot of instrumentation. I don't know if I have it on my computer here or something, but you know, the real underscore is different than, you know, it's more sparse. I don't know if it'll come up on there, but anyway. But sadly, we lost Edgar, so. Tragically and surprisingly, and so that certainly didn't happen. And I really sort of dedicate the film. Whoops. Oh, I don't know what that is. I was trying to play some of the underscore here. I do have the cues.
You need to put out a vinyl. That would be amazing. Like a limited print or something by like Mondo.
You know, I think Paul checked into that, and Edgar was totally into it. And he, you know, I had just gone to see Tangerine Dream play with Paul recently in the last couple of years. And we were going to have, he was going to send over the masters with 2-inch masters. So you have to bake actually to get the to be able to play him again. So they don't come off on a head. And, but it was going to be very expensive. Now I don't think that can happen. I think there's a lot of, you know, controversy or whatever. I'm not sure what's going on, but anyway. They're, I love them. I think they get a bad rep for having scored so many movies in the 80s or being 80s. I mean, they're just amazing music. I mean,
incredible. So
nothing else remotely like them.
No, they made that whole style work. You know, Vangelis Blade Runner score is pretty great too. But yeah,
I love Vangelis. So Steve, really, really quick, and you know, if it's something that, you know, if you don't want to get too much into, that's fine. But I just have to ask, because these movies were so much fun, why didn't we see more Steve DeJarn movies on the big screen?
I was just going to ask that.
Well, you know what, people. Act like, oh, poor me, you know, I was prevented from doing stuff. You don't understand. Watch Tarzana. It's a great little noir short. I had a great career. I started at the top, and I worked my way slowly to the bottom over almost 30 years. I had every opportunity anyone could dream of off of Tarzana. I mean, I was offered all these movies. I wrote the script. It was on the first 10 best lists. I wrote another script that somebody should make, I don't want to make, called Hair of the Dog, set in Nashville, sort of a midnight cowboy, ace in the hole with Nashville songwriters, set in the 60s, sort of a noir thing. I don't want to make it. Somebody should go make it. I never really tried to go make that after Miracle Mile. I was pretty exhausted. I'd put all my money into it. I'd turned down stuff. Been attached to a lot of movies. I was going to do a Hell's Angels movie I discovered Mickey Rourke for. I was going to do D.B. Cooper. Various things you'd get ready to go do. And after sort of being, you know, a guy who only wanted to make my own movies, I drifted into television in the 90s.
Yeah, which you did a lot of.
Did a lot of stuff. And I wrote, you know, every year I would write at least one pilot or two pilots. I mean, I was on their lists. I got 4 pilots made, you know, did some staffing on the X-Files and American Gothic, and later directed about 50 episodes. So, you know, I still turned down some movies after Miracle Mile. I'm not sure that was smart, but I didn't. It took me 8 years of just hanging in there. I'm going to will Miracle Mile into being. And that does take a toll on
absolutely,
things.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I have no regrets that I didn't sort of, you know, become a working, you know, writer and director and make some money. And there's a couple of the pilots I wish would have. Planet Rules, I think, I don't know if I put that in the package. Teo shot that. It's about a rock band. Came very close. I think if a couple of the shows that I did that were actually, we made the physical pilot, they would have gotten on the air. Yeah.
That was the John Hawks show.
John Hawks is in. And, you know, then maybe I'd still be, you know, in the game, because there's certainly television is at an all-time high now in the quality. Whereas
American Gothic came out now, it'd be a hit. It'd be on.
There's a lot of stuff. But
that was way ahead of its time.
Gothic was great. And I came in, I went on to be a producer on the back nine. It was already dead in the water, so they were not bringing it back for whatever reason. So I don't know. TV's great. Now, TV's where the writer is king. The directors sort of, you know, work for the writer. And I subverted my ego and got to direct a bunch of stuff. Directing ER was wonderful. That's such a machine. They don't really need a director, but they have one anyway. Lizzie McGuire was fun, but you couldn't have paid me. You could have offered me $1 million when I was in the 80s and wanted to be a great filmmaker to do a kid's show. I would have not seen myself doing that, but it was a blast doing that stuff. So,
do you think you would ever? You don't think you'd ever make a feature again?
Well, I got off the train and went back and got a master's in creative writing. So I've been writing fiction mainly last few years. Now I am going off to teach at Ohio University, and I'm teaching advanced screenwriting. And I think there's a possibility that I'll try to go back to find out why I wanted to make movies when I did, and maybe I'll write something low budget that, you know, I'll want to do. They got a red camera, you know, that prefers shoot film. And, you know, maybe I'll do that, but I'd probably rather help my girlfriend, who's a filmmaker, make her feature. You know, this is my, I got these two features. I got Tarzana, Eat the Sun, the Hitchcock thing. You know, how many hours of my stuff do you want to watch anyway? That's sort of my
as much as I can.
There's no limit, so it's always we're always looking for the good stuff. So
if there's something I think I also I'd write other scripts and they'd just be so expensive, and so if I do something, it'll be more, you know, a small contained thing somehow. I don't know. It's not impossible, but I'm probably more into you know, putting out my story collection and a novel and stuff. And then maybe I'll do it. I don't know. So,
yeah, if somebody made Cherry 2000 now, it would be like The Fifth Element or something like that. Like the quaintness of movies. And Frank and I have actually been talking about this a lot. It's come up a lot on our talks. Just the old school feeling to those movies from back in the 80s and, you know, 70s, but really the 80s is absent.
80s
is absent. The Joe Dante feeling of cinema is gone.
I love Joe Dante. He ran Miracle Mile. He has his own print of Miracle Mile with Matinee. I have a Matt poster.
Matinee is so wonderful. Movie doesn't get made today. There's no chance Matinee getting made today.
And can you imagine Buckaroo Banzai being made?
Yeah,
no.
So, I mean, that talk about an 80s. Mishmash of things going on. I mean, that's actually Harlan Ellison, the sci-fi writer. He at once scolded me because I was saying something derogatory about Cherry. But, you know, Boy and His Dog, which he wrote, which stars Don Johnson, and Cherry with Melanie, who've been married twice, that couple, that's a great double bill because they're both quirky, you know, post, you know, apocalypse light movies. And I did have a project with Harlan, you know, that would have been fun to do, but a few other things.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, for me, my favorite era in cinema is like the late 60s to the 70s.
Right.
And there's not a lot of people that talk about films from the 80s. And I think there's so many great films that came out of the 80s, and not even the big ones. I mean, Abel Ferrara came from the 80s. I mean, your two films are – do you think you would have made those – do you think they would have been the same had they have not been made in that decade?
Well, I was totally, you know, enamored of 70s film. I mean, you know, 60s too. But, I mean, I was a jock in high school. I only saw movies at the drive-in growing up in my little logging town. I went to Occidental College in L.A. Friends were making movies. And my friends Jim and Ken Wheat, you know, who wrote Pitch Black, they directed an Ewoks TV movie.
Yes,
the Ewok Adventure.
You know, if you want them on the podcast, they're
oh
great.
My God.
Oh, my God.
Frank will have a Frank's having a coronary right now, Steve.
I have a life-size Wicket cardboard stand-up in the corner of my living room.
Of Ewok?
Wicket the Ewok.
Steve, my sister
Ken just gave me an audio cassette with a comic book of an Ewok thing, because my girlfriend's kid just built a Lego Ewok village or something.
Dude, that's on top of my media center. Is the Lego Ewok village?
Okay, well, I'll put you in touch with Ken, because you know they should have gotten into television. They're two brothers, and I really got into movies because they went to the movies every night. I hadn't seen anything, so I'd hop in their car and would go see double bills of everything, and you know. Few years later, I'm the projectionist at BBS, that made Five Easy Pieces, Easy Rider,
right.
Last Picture Show, and I'm working in the Days of Heaven editing room, you know, running Days of Heaven all night for Terry Mount. That was my film school. I went to the AFI, but I dropped out. But you know, being there in that building and you know with that kind of sensibility of you know Terry Malick, watching him. You know, hold, you know, care so much about what went on screen. That's the 70s filming. 80s became MTV, and, you know, there's good things and bad things about that. Bad hair, bad smoke in the backlight. We do point out on the technical commentary, we didn't wet the streets down on Miracle Mile. We didn't use a lot of smoke. So even though it's 80s, it's a sort of a more crystalline look than the cheap, you know, cheap version of Blade Runner, which you can never top. You know, smoke, wet streets, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So.
I can guarantee you, Steve, that there will be we will never have a podcast where Terry Malick and the Ewoks are referenced.
Never.
In paragraph. So I just want to make sure that you know that. And I should also be beaten for calling him Terry.
Yes, you should.
Considering that it is Terrence Malick, probably Mr. Terrence Malick.
No, he's such a misunderstood guy. And I'm so glad he's back sort of doing the Altman thing where he's – or Fassbender. He's just going to make one movie after another till he drops dead.
I hope that's the case because,
he disappeared and he's truly – you know, a remarkable guy. I want to catch up. I haven't seen all these new movies, but, you know, literally I would stay there all night. He once caught me, I'd fetch him food. He once caught me eating his leftover hamburger out of the garbage can. I actually put that in the AFI, what are you doing now thing. And I said, you know, eating Terry Malick's leftovers out of the garbage. He was very nice. He gave me some money, you know, but,
If Terrence Malick gave me money, I don't know if I'd be able to spend it. I probably would have framed it.
You know, Badlands is my favorite low-budget movie. And I just got a new weird poster that this guy –
The Mondo? Did you get the Mondo?
Is it Mondo? It's got a weird colors and
– Yes!
Isn't that great?
I got the orange one. I didn't get the variant.
I can't even open it out of the box now. But Badlands, to me, now there's a movie that was very influential, and and this relates to Cherry. Ed Pressman produced it. Ed Pressman produced Bad Lieutenant, which I think is another masterpiece.
Yeah, his pioneer of one of the pioneers of exceptional independent-minded cinema.
Phantom of the Paradise. I mean, so many movies. I think when Ed goes and does, you know, is attached to big movies, you know, then they're just a big studio movie. But Badlands is something that, you know, you go out and you wait for the light to be right. You have a few characters and you use the landscape as your set. You know, it's possible. That was made for $400,000. You know, if I had the right story and maybe something coming out of my fiction or something, I could see making a Badlands-type film. But not something where you need a giant crew to light up city blocks at night, because you got to have the dough. And you got to find the dough, and that's what breaks your heart. That's what kills you. The reason I'm not making movies is today I have so many friends who are trying to get their movie made. All their energy, all their calories are burned trying to find money and taking stupid meetings. It's not about filmmaking. It's about looking to get financed. And it's just, you know, I had enough of it. So,
well, Steve, this has been truly an awesome conversation. And I just can't say thank you enough for your time and for the stories and for the recollections of these two films. And I know I'm speaking for Frank when I say good luck with your newest endeavor, teaching, which the screenwriting class, which should be wonderful.
That's way cool.
Teaching will be great, and there will be a Miracle Mile website up at some point, and I'll let you know about that so you can spread the word.
Awesome.
Paul Chadwick, who did that art, is a big graphic novelist, did Concrete, which I think is turning into a TV show. So then there's a lot of stuff from the extras, too, that we didn't put on the Blu-ray that'll be on there. So.
Awesome. That's way cool.
We'll be keeping in touch. Anything that you have for Miracle Mile and Cherry, we'd gladly push out there.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Steve.
See ya.